Well, it's a real pleasure and honor to be here. I'd like to thank Jim Eisenberg for the invitation. It's my first time giving a talk at a theoretical physics institute. And it's like going home because my dad had a career. He's retired now as a physicist. He was teaching at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in the physics department there. And I guess, well, he's not in relativity, but they have a relativity group. And I guess he's heard the field of relativity here. And so when I was growing up, I used to just go to the physics department, you know, as a kid, you know, just hang along with my dad. We lived about a mile away. I walk, you know, with him to school, and it's really wonderful to be in that environment again. And, well, the first thing I want to talk about is the title. And this is a disappointment, probably, but it's called Survey of Ricci Flow. I was a little bit derelict in giving Jim the title. I didn't came up with a much better one related to geometrization, but I really don't know much about that aspect. So I'll just talk about a survey of what's been going on the last 20 years, the little that I know. Okay. Okay, so Ricci flow started with Richard Hamilton's work. That was back in 1982, actually, in a paper in Journal of Differential Geometry, introduced the Ricci flow equations. And what you look at is a manifold. And this can be non-compact, but much of the work has been in the compact case. And although recent work, a lot of very interesting results in non-compact case. So we'll assume that this manifold is compact. Okay, and then we'll just stick an arbitrary Riemannian metric, G0. Here. And we think of that as an initial metric for a one-parameter family of metrics that will flow in time, where time is going forward. Okay, so we're going to, given this, we're going to look for a one-parameter family, G of T. We don't know what time interval this may exist on, so T is in some interval from 0 to capital T. We want to flow as long as we can. And how do we find this one-parameter family? Well, we start off with the initial metric G naught. So G of 0 will be G naught. And then we write down a differential equation for this metric. So the differential equation is the time derivative of the metric is, let's say, later on I won't specify where evaluate. It's always going to be evaluated at some point in space and time. So X will be in the manifold and T is time. And the equation that, the Ricci flow equation is this. The time derivative of the metric, okay, so that, so variation of the metric is this metric 2 tensor. We specify that to be minus 2, the Ricci tensor. Okay, so that, of course, is an invariant equation, which I'm writing in local coordinates. So this is the Ricci flow equation. Okay, so the question is, well, we have, so the metric here, so that is always, I'm always going to assume that's Riemannian. Okay, so it's going to be somewhat different than the I guess, Lorentz case, where you get, you know, essentially hyperbolic equations or hyperbolic elliptic type system. Okay, so this is, so the Ricci tensor, the second order operator in the metric, will roughly look like the Laplacian of the metric. So in a sense, this really looks like a heat equation. So this is really the it's a very strong analogy. And we'll see that in some estimates, a strong analogy with a heat equation. Okay, so let's say we have some function of space and time. Space could be a manifold or Euclidean space, whatever. But it's really a lot of techniques related to those for the heat equation. Okay, well, the first question is, can we really flow this metric? See, we've written down an equation. Doesn't mean that there necessarily is such a one-parameter family metric. So, you know, we start out with our Riemannian manifold. Maybe there's some topology, Mn. And what we want to do is we want to evolve this, and so the shape will be smoothly changing in time. The question is, what happens? The topology, of course, will stay the same, but maybe the curvature could go to infinity, and we could have singularities forming. And that will be a concern. Okay, but at least that will not happen in short time. So there's a short time existence theorem. And the original proof was rather complicated, and there was a, so that's due to Hamilton, this paper. And it's also, there was a simplified proof. So, proof by Dieterc. That came maybe within a year of that. And what this says is there exists, okay, so the theorem is that for every G naught, so we always assume that everything we encounter is smooth. So this metric initially would be C infinity, a smooth metric. Okay, for every G naught, there exists some epsilon, which of course may depend on G naught, which will depend on G naught, such that a solution G of T to the Ricci flow exists for T contained in zero epsilon, and with initial metric to be given, or given initial metric. So it doesn't matter what our initial metric is. We can always flow for a little time, and this solution will be smooth.
Okay.
So yes, we have to assume that, we assume that the manifold is compact. But there's results, say, if it's not compact with bounded curvature, then there's a short time existence there. But then in the non-compact, it may not be unique. Okay, so let me just put an exclamation mark to indicate that it's unique. Whoops, that's not. I want to say right here, in the right place. Obviously, the epsilon is not here. The maximal time is, though, and that's the. Okay, the idea there is to break the gauge invariance here, because if we just fix a diffeomorphism, say, of the manifold to itself, we could pull back the initial metric by that diffeomorphism, that geometric equivalent. And the Ricci tensor is also, you know, pulls back. And because of that, it turns out the symbol of the operator has some zeros because of its gauge invariance. Okay, and that's actually, well, gauge invariance is a nice thing about the equation, but it causes a little bit of problem for short time existence. What he did is he broke the gauge invariance, but roughly by coupling it with a harmonic map heat flow. And then using this diffeomorphism to pull back and to break the gauge invariance and to show that you get an equivalent equation which is strictly parabolic. Okay, so that's roughly the idea. In any case, we're just going to assume this. And what we're going to talk about later is really independent of the short time existence theorem, the techniques used to prove there. So the flavor is going to be quite different. Okay, so once we have the short time existence, we know we can flow a little bit. Question is, what will stop the flow? Okay, and that's a, let's call it a long time existence. And this was actually also established in this 1982 paper. Okay. And what that says is the following. So if on a time interval 0 to tau, we have that the curvature, and I'll just use Rm. So this will denote the Riemann. This is my abbreviation for the Riemann curvature tensor. OK, so if you look at the curvature tensor at all points in space and time on m cross this time interval, if this is uniformly bounded, then we get a limit solution as tau, as t approaches tau, and we can continue the solution even further. Okay, so then we can extend the solution g of t, t contained in 0 tau, uniquely to a solution g of t, t. Now we can go a little bit, let's call it delta, say, for some delta positive. So we can continue our solution a little bit past tau. As long as the curvature doesn't blow up, go to infinity, we can keep on going. So we know that if we have a maximal time interval, that the sup of the curvature in space and time has to be infinite. Okay, so that's, and then we say we have a singular solution. Okay, so this is, you know, this is a very general type of result. So as you can imagine, the proof is not that specific to Ricci flow. It uses more the fact that this analogy with the heat equation here, this kind of smoothing property. So when we kind of want to look at more detailed behavior of the Ricci flow, we should really use some very specific things about this Ricci flow equation. Okay, so.
But let's see, it does, I mean, if you had modified that equation by adding a curvature square term on the right, so that would probably change the character, right?
Yeah, so then when you linearize, often if you look at linearization, then you have like curvature, then maybe times the second order operator, that quadratic. And then it may depend on the sign of the curvature. So there's another, for example, let me just quickly mention. So one thing about the Ricci tensor, if it's positive definite, I don't know if I can remember which direction this goes. I think it, if you look at the identity, and I may get it wrong, because I haven't really thought about this for a while, but something like this. The second contracted Bianchi identities actually tell you that this is a harmonic map. Like you take the Laplacian of identity map with respect to this base metric, G, and then Ricci in the domain that this is 0. And this is like equivalent to the fact that the divergence of Ricci is 1/2 covering. So we got something like that. And that's something interesting, you know, about the Ricci tensor. Now, there's another thing you can do. If you look at, I think it's 1/2 R GIJ, right? So we look at the Einstein tensor. And we can diagonalize, let's say it's A, B, C, diagonalize. And these are the principal sectional curvatures of a three manifold. So we're using the fact they're in three dimensions. So the Ricci tensor looks like B plus C, et cetera. And what you can do is you can come up with another tensor, HIJ, which is the product, like this. And the middle term would be like AC and then AB. And then we could, and this would be an example of something quadratic here. And what happens here is that this is kind of dual to the Ricci tensor. If you take the identity map, MH to MG, this is harmonic. This is a harmonic map. Okay, so we could come up with an equation. If I remember correctly, I think what we do is you do actually a plus. You're probably wondering about this 2 here. Okay, and the only reason that's there is because otherwise we'd make the analogy with 1/2 there. And so if you just, it's kind of a convention what you want to do with that.
So that equation with H, so H is roughly a curvature squared kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's still, it's still a parabolic equation?
See, that's the example, that's why I mentioned it, because this would say the sectional curvature is negative, and it's parabolic. And I think if you put a minus sign, then if you assume the sectional curvature is positive, then that's parabolic. Okay, and actually there's some integral quantities measuring a difference from being hyperbolic that actually decay. There's some monotonicity formulas. So this is Hamilton. This goes way back. I think we looked at this maybe 17 years ago or something. We got some estimates. We never published this, actually. There exists some monotonicity formulas. Well, let me say this, monotone quantities. Okay, so when we have these like quadratic things, it often will depend on the sign of the curvature. And the wonderful thing about this is this really looks like a heat equation with respect to the evolving metric. Okay, so we can make an analogy like that. Of course, really what you have is the metric here, not just a scalar. It's a really strong analogy here. Okay, so what we're interested in after long time existence is like global existence. This is kind of the best thing, existence. And that's kind of the optimal thing, and convergence. Okay, so expect that not always to hold. I mean, it's trying to smooth things, but if you think about it, if you get to a fixed point, that would be an Einstein manifold. Say in dimension 3, that would be just a, you know, section of curvatures would be 0. That would be a flat manifold. Or in any dimension, you just get to a Ricci flat manifold. That would be a fixed point. And not every manifold would have such a metric, right? So, you know, what's going to happen if you can't get to this metric? You know, what would be possible? And well, what happens often is that singularities have to occur. Okay.
The psi conventions here just down with unit sphere will blow up.
Right. So actually, I should have mentioned that. So the unit sphere will shrink down, and you could write out like an ODE for what the radius is. I forgot what it is. You know, it's like a constant minus time, things like that. I think it's becoming like that. So this will shrink. So that's the key thing. So the sine convention is that with positive curvature will make it shrink, and then the like a hyperbolic thing will make it expand. So that's why it's often normalized, this flow. Like you normalize the volume and then study the convergence. So really here we should really say after.
Why am I supposed to think thermodynamically from the singularity as I go in the future?
No, I don't. I have to make a confession here. I always thought when I was a kid I'd learn some physics. Because my dad is a physicist. And you know, I asked him, you know, can I learn something? Well, yeah, you know, that's easy. You know, I'm here, you know, for you. You can. And then I never learned anything from my dad. And this is something I severely regret today, because we're interested in some relations between like RG flow and Ricci flow, and you know, would love to know more about string theory, and I just don't have that background, and
I
can't answer it. I don't know.
Sort of a simple answer to Jeff's question.
Okay, good.
on the way to going to a point, all the deviations from the spherical will smooth out. And so even though it's going to a point in a finite time, on the way, all the stuff that's, you know, all the inhomogeneities, all the anisotropies.
I thought that happened when you blew up a balloon, that was inhomogeneity.
Well, we're seeing, so this is a perfect time to, to state such a result, right? So we have results in two dimensions and three dimensions here for that. So the 2D result actually is interesting. So. So this is actually, most of the work is due to Hamilton on this. And then there's one last remaining case that was open, and then I finished that case. So this, and what this says is we start out with any metric. So start with any, well, we're always assuming compact here. We'll assume M is compact. Start with any G0 on M2. So now the key thing is we're in the lowest non-trivial dimension, the surface, and there's things like the uniformization theorem, you know, etc. And you know, you can think about things from the point of view of complex analysis too, but we'll just think about it in terms of Riemannian surface. Start with any metric, then the equation, so ddt of g. And what we'll do is look at this equation first. I'm going to put something to normalize it. And since we're in two dimensions, the Ricci tensor is exactly, note that the Ricci tensor n equals 2 is exactly 1/2 the scalar curvature times the metric. So this is the Ricci flow in dimension 2. And what we'll do is we'll just put in an average here. So like we'll put R average. Okay, now this average value could depend on time, but since we have the total scalar curvature is constant by Gauss-Bonnet formula, this average curvature is actually a constant in time too. So that's another nice fact about this normalization, which is not true in higher dimensions, except in the Kähler case when you have a complex manifold. But like on, yes, it's changing equation, which is normalizing the area, but geometrically it's not changed in the sense that if I have a solution to the original Ricci flow, solution to this new equation, if I change the parameter of time, and I change the metric by scaling, just a homothety, I can go from one solution to the other. Okay. So geometrically in that sense, they're equivalent. And here, the key thing is that the area of g of t is equal to a constant. Okay, then what happens if you look at this equation, the solution exists for all time, the equation has, and we'll assume with initial metric g of 0, g naught, has a solution for all t in 0 infinity. And the limit, let's write it this way, I'll just be kind of sloppy here, of the metric, this isn't any C infinity norm, in any CK, all K, is this limit exists. So as T approaches infinity, you get a limit metric. All the metrics will be uniformly equivalent. You get a limit metric, this will be smooth, and will have constant curvature. Okay, so this will, which is a smooth metric with constant curvature. Okay, so. Yeah, we can assume that it's oriented. It's because you know. No, we don't need that. We could just sometimes we talk about. You know, the volume form, things like that, you just go to a double cover, right? So, yeah, you could just, it really doesn't depend on it. I mean, one easy way out is just if it's not orientable, just go to a double cover, and you just lift the metric, which is just, whatever, Z2 equivariant. Okay, so what happens is let's say you take an ovaloid, like an S2, if you don't normalize, this shrinks to a point. So this is under a Ricci flow as the movie goes along in time, and this shrinks to a point, but it comes rounder and rounder. Maybe I should go like that. Like that. And but if you normalize, then you see the convergence to infinity to a fixed metric. Okay, so that's the 2D result. So actually what Hamilton did is he, using the maximum principle, so I'll discuss maximum principle a little bit more, he basically covered the negative Euler characteristic case. And the harder case was the positive Euler characteristic case. And there, I would like to mention one estimate, actually, that he came up with. Okay, so a particular interesting case is when the Euler characteristic of our surface is positive. If we assume it's orientable, that will mean that our surface is diffeomorphic to the two-sphere. Okay, so in this case, what he assumed was he made an additional assumption, which is initial metric is positive curvature. Okay. So kind of like this picture, I just imagine, there's the Weyl embedding theorem, which says that you can isometrically embed any positively curved sphere into Euclidean 3 space. So you can imagine it like that. But of course, this flow is intrinsic. And there, you had a monotonicity, called monotonicity formula, which says the following, that if you look at, or entropy formula, he defined entropy, and this, I guess, is just by formal analogy. Not really, I don't think it's for some physical reason. You look at the curvature, since that's, and then times natural logarithm of the curvature, right, r log r, then integrate that with respect to area element. Okay, so if we look at that, then under this equation, so we're flowing by this normalized Ricci flow, then this time derivative is less than or equal to 0. Okay, and that was one of the ingredients in the proof. Okay, so you get basically, what is it saying? Well, Gauss-Bonnet formula tells us that integral r dA is constant, right? And when you raise the power to some power bigger than 1, you get more information, right? Because it's, if the curvature is bumping up a little bit, then, taking higher powers, you get more information on that. So, basically a limit, take the right thing, you'll limit to the L infinity norm. Okay, so this is like a slightly larger power than one, and it gives you control actually. If you can estimate somehow the gradient of the curvature, you get estimates on the gradient of curvature sufficiently, then you can control the curvature here. And that's what you want to do. You don't want singularities to occur. And that's how combined with a certain gradient estimate. Okay, and there's various gradient estimates that are true for Ricci flow, and in particular, one way to do this, there's a couple ways, is a Harnack type estimate. And the reason I mention this Harnack estimate is because it's very fundamental in the higher dimensional flow. So this works for high D. Okay, so combined with this, yeah.
What happens to the torus?
The torus, okay, so that's there, what one can show is by, okay, so, and actually, I'll let you know in a second. I'll just finish this up. Yeah. I just wanted to complete this one sentence. Combined with the gradient estimate, this implies the curvature is bounded. Well, I'm actually oversimplifying things, but one actually shows a positive lower bound on R and then uses a gradient estimate to show a positive upper bound. Okay. And this is used with other estimates like, controlling the diameter. You wouldn't want, if the area is normalized, you wouldn't want something to stretch out, right? Even if positive curvature, the curvature could become very large, right? And correspondingly, the diameter could be very large. Okay. But all those things are controlled, diameter and curvature. Okay, so that's what happens for the order character is positive. Of course, if you look at the next case, which is a torus, right? And basically what happens is the order characteristic gets more negative, right? There's basically three cases, positive, zero, or negative. It gets easier as the order characteristic gets more negative. And here, there are maximum principal estimates. So. Okay, so why are these maximum principal estimates important? Because they control pointwise various quantities. That means if you have a quantity which satisfies the heat equation, then you have a pointwise bound. And so these things, these maximum principal estimates work in higher dimensions. So I just want to come back to here. This Harnack estimate works in higher dimensions under some assumption on curvature. But this monotonicity formula, at least in this form, so,
Ben?
Yes.
I'm not sure how many people would know what Harnack estimates are.
Okay, I could. I'll go over the maximum principal estimate and get back to this. So this is a little bit more involved, I'll start with this one. And this will be a good preview for the Harnack estimate. So right now it's kind of a black box. I'm not really saying what it is. A certain type of gradient estimate. So in this form, so far not known for higher dimensions. Even in the Kähler case, so if you assume Kähler, you assume maybe, well, this is kind of a Kähler type thing because you went on a Riemann surface, that's Kähler one dimension. So this is not known. So you probably heard of work of Perlman recently, and he has monotonicity forms, but they're quite different. And they're also related, it's somehow really like entropy too, but in a completely different way than this. Okay, and his estimates are extremely powerful. It's actually some of the most powerful estimates in Ricci flow now. What's quite amazing is many of his results are just n-dimensional. Yeah, that's really impressive. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about maximum principal estimates. So if I have a solution to a heat equation like this, Okay, so this is really, it's very elementary in the sense that it just goes back to the second derivative test in calculus. So if we just look at 1D, and the exact same argument is true in RD, look at my solution at a given time. So let's say this is the profile of U. Then if we're at a maximum of U, or just a global maximum, which implies local maximum, the second derivative is negative. So what that means is, and correspondingly, the Laplacian, actually the whole Hessian of U, is going to be negative semi-definite. So if x naught, t naught is a spatial, just in the space, spatial maximum of U, so U attains its maximum at that time t0 at this point x naught, then we know that ddt of U at that point is equal to the Laplacian. That's simply our heat equation, and this is less than equal to zero. And you can, of course, make this rigorous to show that the maximum decreases and corresponding to the minimum increases. So the heat, right, in this case, the average heat will be, the total heat will be constant. So the heat wants to smooth out like that, just purely. Okay, so it looks like, well, you can't do too much with this thing. But the nice thing is this. If we have a heat equation, we could come up with quantities involving derivatives of our solution, et cetera, and try to put them in here and get nice formulas here. Okay, so if I have a solution here, what I could do is just kind of cook up something Q of U, gradient of U, you know, maybe Hessian of U, et cetera, right? And then we could cook up something like this. There's many choices. Try to find a good choice. And so so what you want is a good choice. Might give you an equation like ddt of Q is, well, the nicest thing perhaps would be this, like that, something like that. And if you can do something like that, then you can estimate this quantity, and you can estimate derivatives of curvature. So that's what we mean by gradient estimate here, because this is a gradient. And if you think of this maybe as like time, this is one time derivative if you make it a Laplacian. Okay, so that's the idea. And the maximum principal estimates tell you, so I won't go into detail about that, but they tell you, actually, you have to do some modification, is that the curvature is uniformly bounded here. So the torus case is quite different than the positive curvature case, where you use entropy here, you just use maximum principle. And what happens if the Euler characteristic is negative? Okay, so just one final remark about that. Euler characteristic negative implies that if we look at the curvature minus its average, R average, by considering the right quantities, you can show that this decays exponentially in time. Okay. So this kind of explains why the Euler characteristic negative cases is easier, because in some sense, the Euler characteristic comes in this constant here, you know, minus c. If it's positive Euler characteristic, you only get exponential increasing bound, which is not going to help you. And this is kind of in between. What is that?
And let's see, so this argument for S2, you said, assumes the initial metric is positive scalar curvature.
Yeah.
But that's now been weakened.
So that's where I came in. So I modified the techniques and modified the entropy. Yeah, and showed some. You don't show monotonicity, but you show boundedness. And that's.
So, but monotonicity still requires that assumption.
Yeah, positively. So if you don't have monotonicity, you modify, you only show that this quantity is uniformly bound in time, not necessarily monotone. But that's enough for what you want to do.
It seems like the positive case is clearly the hardest in two dimensions.
Yeah, because
it was easier in three dimensions, if I remember.
Right? Yeah, because somehow it has to, it's a Kähler thing. Because like the moduli space of Riemann surfaces is much larger, right, as you go with the Euler characteristic being more negative, right, the genus increasing. But if you fix a conformal class, a pointwise conformal class, then there's a unique metric. So in each conformal class, you have uniqueness, but there are many conformal classes. But when you do Ricci flow in two dimensions, you stick in a conformal class. You stay there. And that's why it's the uniqueness of where you want to get to that makes it easier. Whereas you have these conformal diffeomorphisms, right? Merbius transformations of the two-sphere. So it's non-unique, even the conformal class. And you actually have non-compactness because you can concentrate. There's essentially, by the stereographic projection, corresponds to scaling in R2. And you can concentrate things at points. And so that's, if you go to orbifolds, it has to do with the fact that when order characters is positive, there's bad orbifolds. And there, you actually don't get constant curvature metrics. And there's,
So, am I correct in assuming that the torus goes to flat?
The torus goes to flat. So everything goes to constant curvature. So it'll be just going to, the curvature goes to its average. And then you know the sign from the order characteristic. Yeah. Okay, so what are Harnack estimates? So this, like, this works for, like, solutions to Laplace equations, right, in complex analysis. And so what does it mean for a parabolic equation? Okay, so let's look at the heat equation. Okay, so Harnack estimates compares curvatures at two different points. And you can obtain that comparison by integrating out a gradient estimate. Okay, so the fundamental idea is to try to prove this by, we prove actually gradient estimates. Okay, so in this particular form, I would say more specifically, like, apply the heat equation or harmonic functions, say on manifolds. This form is due to Yao in 75, and then number works. They had number works, some with also with Yao and Cheng, S.Y. Cheng. And then in the parabolic case, so for the heat equation, which Yao and Peter Lee and Yao. Peter Lee at UCI. Okay, so that's what I'll explain now, is what's going on with these Lee and Yao estimates. Okay, so if we start out with the solution to heat equation, so we know the fundamental solution. So this is something like 1 over 4 pi t to the n over 2 times e to the minus norm. Well, we could base it at some point. Or t like that. So we could write u of x, y, t like that. And let's just actually just forget about the base point, just take norm of x squared like that, centered at origin. So it starts out as a delta function at the origin at time 0. Okay, so this is the fundamental solution of the heat equation. And you could look at this solution to kind of motivate what type of quantities might be good. Okay, so how can we do that? So the idea is, let's say we're just interested in the behavior in space, space-type quantities, and we don't worry about time functions. So we see this exponential, and we therefore take a logarithm of that. So we take the natural log of u, which is just some, it's very easy to write the function, but we won't care about what this function is in time. So we get some function in time, and then we get this thing right here. So if we don't really worry about this constant here, it's just a simply norm squared, right, of your position in space. Okay. And what we can do there is we can convert that to constant by taking two derivatives. So we can take a Laplacian of logarithm of u. This is equal to minus, this Laplacian will give us a 2n. So this will be a minus n over 2t. Okay, so this is true. This equality is true for the fundamental solution on Euclidean space. Okay, so what Li and Yao did is they looked at this exact quantity on Riemannian manifolds. So the idea was you take a manifold with a fixed metric. Now we're no longer looking at Ricci flow. We're fixing the metric. For simplicity, to get the best estimate, let's assume the Ricci curvature is non-negative. Okay, and so here, what they did is the following. They defined a quantity Q, which is equal to simply Laplacian of log U plus N over 2T. And of course, I should add that our solution to our heat equation should be positive because we're taking a logarithm. So this is just a definition. And you can use the heat equation for U to rewrite this as a gradient type quantity, as just the first derivative quantity, dT of log U minus gradient log U norm squared plus over 2. That's what it works out to. And now it turns out for this quantity, which for the fundamental solution of Euclidean space vanishes, in general, it satisfies a very nice evolution equation, just like something like this. Okay, except now it looks like this. So let me write out what it is. It's some equation, something like this. ddt of q is actually bigger or equal to Laplacian of q. Okay, at a spatial maximum, that pushes it down, right? At spatial minimum, this pushes it up, right? And the next thing is we get a gradient quantity. And of course, the first derivative is zero at a spatial minimum, so that doesn't do anything. This has no effect here. And you could put any vector field here, and that wouldn't matter. And it turns out the vector field is something like 2, the gradient of u over u. But from the point of view of this maximum principle, the only important thing is that we have a vector field times the gradient of q here. And the wonderful thing is that we get a quadratic term pushing it up like this, plus 2 over n q squared. Now, if one wants to study qualitatively what happens with this by the maximum principle, what the maximum principle says, these two quantities have a positive effect on trying to push the solution up. So we might as well just forget about the inequality and look at the ODE. So we have a PDE here. We look at the ODE just by formally just call lowercase q, put equality here, and just write formally exactly the same thing without that Laplacian term. And if we want a lower bound for capital Q, we might as well have the limit as t goes to 0 of q of t be minus infinity. Right? We start with a solution that starts with minus infinity. This is really pushing it up. It's a square term that's going to push it up. And that will do that in finite time. And what happens is, what is that solution? It's exactly this. This is solved by, and that's easy calculation, that q of t is equal to minus n over 2t. And so really, you can formulate, so what's the result? Okay, so the theorem is this. So put it here. So the theorem of Li and Yao, so 1986, is that, well, one of their results, they actually do many more results, including adding a potential to the heat equation. Okay, the result is that under these conditions, that the Ricci is not negative, the theorem is simply that Q is bigger or equal to 0. Okay, and let's see, not, I don't have that right. I guess I'm calling, I'm not doing this right. I should, okay, I made a little, well, I made a mistake here, right? I should, I don't want to call, yeah, that's what I want to call Q. Okay, so I want to call Q just to be this part right here. So this part Q is this part. Then I get this equation. So I wrote down the wrong equations here. And therefore, what we're showing is Q is bigger or equal to, it should be, the correct thing should be N over 2T, like that. Okay, so this is an elementary example of how to prove a gradient estimate. Just get this quadratic. Yeah.
What are you saying
about U in this theorem? About U, just positive, positive solution to the heat equation on a compact, or, well, you can assume complete, but let's say compact to make, assume compact with non-negative Ricci curvature. And then there's corresponding, there's estimates, there's slightly weaker estimates for Ricci curvature lower bound. but so far no sharp estimate is known. And this is clearly sharp, like in Euclidean space. And that's why I presented that. Okay. Okay, so then this can be integrated to get a pointwise bound. So this, so Harnack gives pointwise bound comparisons. I'm kind of running out of time. I'll just quickly write out the equation. If I have a point in space, a later time, compare that to another point in space, a solution at an earlier time, let's say this is an earlier time, then what happens is you have a certain amount of heat somewhere, it can't decrease as you, if you don't go far out distance. So this thing has a lower bound, which is something like T1 over T2, this ratio of these two times. Same power n over 2. Okay, so this is less than 1. Then you have e to a negative power. And that negative power gets smaller as the distance between the two points increases. Distance squared should scale like time, so we divide by the time difference. And the time difference is 0. You have no comparison between, you know, temperature at two different points. And this is kind of like a classical version of Harnack, where you compare compare solutions at two different points. Okay, and the reason I mentioned this proof is that in terms of Ricci flow, since the maximum principle can be applied here, then this technique is is very useful in higher dimensions. When should I finish my talk? That's a question I have. Do you have 10 minutes? Okay. Okay, so there's a lot of, you know, I think there are a lot of interesting techniques. I wish I had time to explain more of the techniques. It's a lot of what I find interesting about Ricci flow. Okay, but since I'm running out of time, I thought maybe I could survey a few more of the results, you know, get a better idea of generally what's going on. So back in 82, what Hamilton did was he showed the following theorem, that if M3G is a compact three manifold with positive Ricci curvature. Okay, so we have a differentiable three manifold compact, emits a metric with positive Ricci curvature. This implies that this three manifold is diffeomorphic to a spherical space form. So it's going to be diffeomorphic to a standard S3. You know, think of it as a unit S3, mod out by a finite group of isometries of a standard metric, so a subgroup of O4. So this thing is a discrete finite subgroup of O4. Okay, so that's the result. So it doesn't really follow. I think so far there's no other proof of this, because you could say, well, Meyer's theorem says the fundamental group is finite because of this. Therefore, the universal cover is simply connected. A three-manifold, it's a homotopy three-sphere. But then you have to assume Poincaré conjecture to show that this would be a standard three-sphere. But even if you knew that, what's not known is what's called a spherical space form conjecture, which groups can act on it, whether they're conjugate to a, you know, linear group of isometries. Okay, so this result is actually what was and still is, I guess, a new result about such manifolds. Okay, and what happens is it's a little bit intuition about the general case. So what one is interested is just three manifolds with an arbitrary metric. In 2D, there's a big difference. So let's draw a neck. Okay, so here, what happens is because there's no intrinsic curvature in the circle, actually what happens is this looks like a saddle and the curvature is negative, so things want to expand. So if we have a neck here in 2D, this thing expands like that. Okay, so now one can draw the analogous picture in 3D. And there's a big difference, because if I draw a neck like this and say put in a two-sphere, here, this two-sphere has intrinsic curvature. And if we think of it kind of as being like a cylinder, this line direction, nothing will happen, and this will shrink down. And what happens here is actually there's a result of, recent result, surprisingly it's been open for a long time, that one can actually pinch, one actually can form a singularity for certain initial conditions. Okay, so in three dimensions, singularities can happen. And this is called a neck pinch, same type of singularity. And the way it's, and what's surprising about three dimensions is that one really expects, and it's, this is, a lot of this is being confirmed by Perlman's work and Hamilton's earlier work on formation of singularities, that under, that there are very few types of singularities that can happen for three manifolds, and this is one of them. We have a neck pinch that really asymptotically becomes a cylinder pinching down in his neck. And this allows one to do surgeries here. One can replace an interval, a B1 cross S2. One can convert that into an S0, which is 2 points cross B3. So it's like cutting out two spheres and capping with balls here. One performs a surgery. And this is related to a connected sum decomposition or removing handles. Okay, so this really does happen, and basically has to be one of the few things that has to happen. That means you can come up with examples of this, but not only that, just under, just basically for arbitrary initial data, there should be very, very specific things that can only happen. Okay, so that's the work of Hamilton and Perlman. Okay, so this is how it's related to prime decomposition in topology. Okay, now there's another type of singularity that can happen. There's more complicated singularities, and this is actually conjectured by Hamilton and confirmed in, theoretically by mean curvature flow. By Angen and Velasquez, and numerically by David Garfinkel and Jim Eisenberg, so recently in Ricci flow. And what can happen is something more complicated, I'll go something analogous to what they're looking at, is instead of pinching down a neck, what could happen, well, I'm not drawing very well, but this inside part right here could pinch down, and one can kind of develop a cusp singularity. And one wants to kind of take a microscope and look at what happens near singularities and dilate about singularities. Right here, when you have a neck pinch, if you do the correct dilation, what you see is in the limit, you see an ideal solution, which is a round two-sphere. So this picture, if you really blow this up, it has to be like this. So this is a limit solution. And actually, one of the aspects of the proof of this is using the entropy in two dimensions. Okay, so because you notice that in the limit, the curvature becomes positive, and you're allowed to use entropy. And so that's another thing, is that at small scales and limits, curvature wants to become positive when you're in three dimensions, is because you're low dimensions. And that's another important reason to just consider the positive case, because it's a limit case. So this case is, even if you're just interested in the general case for three manifolds, these cases are very important, just positive curvature. There's limits. Here, one can dilate, and one sees a rotate, should one should see a rotationally symmetric solution like this. Like that. And this thing is different than this solution, because this solution is homothetically shrinking. Okay, so it's shrinking here. And this solution right here is not moving under Ricci flow. Well, how can that be? If it doesn't move, it must be Ricci flat. Well, I mean not moving in the sense of isometry. So the metric at time t it really does move is a pullback by one parameter family diffeomorphisms of initial metric. So this is another type of limit. And this one's called, you can solve it by, you can find it by solving ODE, and it's called the Bryant soliton. Okay, so that is a lot of the focus in general, and then one wants to understand singularities. Rule out some other, so basically these are the two types of singularities that have to occur. I'm really oversimplifying this a lot. But there's some other major type of singularities that can be ruled out by the work of Perlman. And so what, just the general program, I'm just say a couple words, is that you start with arbitrary three manifold, put an arbitrary metric compact. You want to flow, you approach the singularity. Right before a singularity, you show that there's some time where you can do a surgery. Flow again, encounter another surgery, and just keep on doing that. And try to deduce the fact that you have a geometric decomposition on each of the resulting pieces. Okay, so that's the idea. So there's a lot of things I haven't talked about what happens as time goes infinity, why things should be nice. But you can imagine as time goes infinity with all the smoothing properties of Ricci flow, that, you know, good things could happen. But that's, I just leave that. And just, just wanted to let you know a little bit about these singularities. I think that's really interesting.
Singularity forms in 2D.
So that doesn't. So what happens is no singularities form.
No singularities.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually interesting that you can rule out those cusps by an isoparametric estimate. So besides that proof, there are other new proofs. One is due to Hamilton to rule out certain types of singularities.
It looked like you had a shrinking sphere at the left there in 2D, and then a hyperbole. Saddle
okay.
To the right of it. So it had a chance of collapsing one way. And
yeah, it's kind of unclear because those, you know, when one thinks about it, just kind of intuitively think, well, maybe something happens, right? And one, you know, one doesn't really know. And so, but okay, so basically, this, I guess my talk is finished. I guess. Just answer this question. So I'll just answer that question. There's actually some very nice singularity. So
there's
2D singularity, possible singularity. And this doesn't happen. Okay, so that's what we showed, but and there's other proofs. And actually what's wonderful is that this possible singularity was not expected to happen in 3D, but it was extremely hard. No one could figure out how to prove that, and that's what Perlman showed, that this cannot happen, and he proved even stronger results. And so it's really amazing what he has done. And this possible singularity, I think you'll like this because it's also occurs in physics, is a very simple solution. You take R2, and you consider this metric dx squared plus dy squared, and you write this metric. Okay, so maybe you'll recognize in this form, or perhaps you'll recognize it in the other form. This is the measure G is equal to dr squared plus tanh squared r d theta squared. Like that. Okay, so we call this like Hamilton's cigar soliton, and it's also known as Wynn's black hole. And I guess in the physics literature, also known as a cigar. So what this is a positively curved surface, which is asymptotic to a cylinder, defined on R2. The curvature decays exponentially. So in terms of, if I use these coordinates, the curvature is equal to twice hyperbolic secant squared of R. So it's positive and decays exponentially. So this is a stationary solution to Ricci flow. So what that means is, if I take ddt of in 2D of g, this is minus 2 Ricci, right, which is minus R G. This is also the Hessian. Okay. So this is, so we saw these equations in Professor Pluchinski's book too. And these are, this is the stationary solution. So what this means is this is a lead with respect to a gradient vector field of the metric. So that means the metric is evolving by diffeomorphisms, generating a gradient vector field, or generated by a gradient vector field. So this is a stationary solution in the space of matrix mod diffeomorphism. It doesn't move. So it goes to fixed points. So and that was a possible singularity, and that doesn't occur. And it'd be interesting if there's physics, I guess, proofs, or you know, heuristic proofs or proof of these things, you know, where.
Why is this singularity? Because the curvature constant.
A possible singularity. So possible singularities are fixed points. Whenever we have a fixed point, a solution to this equation that could be a singularity model. That means if I have a singularity, I take a limit, I get a limit solution. It could be like this. This could be a limit solution, a blow up, yeah. It could approach asymptotically at a very small scale, this. And the thing is that it doesn't happen in 2D and didn't know it in higher dimensions. What's incredible is that Perlman has shown it doesn't happen in any dimension, you know, in biomonotonicity by really using entropy, what he calls entropy. Yeah, and that's actually the action that's also in string theory, right? you look at, you know, R, the scalar curvature, plus let me see if I get this right. Gradient f squared, right, e to the minus f dv. Right. Okay, so you define this energy of two fields, metric and, right, a function, this dilaton right here. Okay, so that's what Perlman did, and he actually modified it. What's wonderful is he put a parameter here, wg, okay, tau. And, gosh, I have to remember what the formula is. I kind of forgot this. Okay, something like this. And part of this is motivated by F being a solution to the conjugate heat equation. Okay, so something like this. You modify, so this might be interesting to you how you modify minus F, plus F minus N, like this. And then there's these constants are important, tau to the minus N over 2, e to the minus F, maybe. Okay, so this is essentially what he showed that under. You couple the Ricci flow with equations for the dilaton and tau, and you show that this is monotone. And what's amazing is that you could prove that this singularity doesn't occur in any dimension because of this. Okay, this thing is collapsing kind of at infinity. There are short loops in large balls because I can go up the cylinder. I can scale things down. The curvature doesn't get too big, right, because it's exponentially decaying. I just get if I scale this picture, I get a very short loop, and I can still make it almost flat. And I can make this a very large geodesic ball. This thing actually prevents that. And what's incredible is that if you consider invariance just in the metric, you can't prove anything like that so far. You really need this dilaton here. And you actually not only, well, actually, you actually do an eigenvalue. You minimize over f. So this is like a Dirichlet integral. Minimize that, and you use a bound for that. So you come up with an invariant by minimizing over f with a constraint, just and you come up with an invariant g and tau like that. And you can minimize among tau, but it's basically that. You get rid of the dilaton. And because of that, you can rule out these short loops. And that was conjectured by Hamilton. Yeah. I guess I'd probably stop there.
I remember before Perelman, Hamilton used to say he could just prove the right Harnack inequality, he could do everything he wanted.
Yes, so that's
still an effort, or has it been swept away by
I think depends on your viewpoint. Well, first of all, it depends on whether Perelman is correct, right? And I guess, I don't know if anyone knows that, right? It's
well, that part's correct, right?
That one is indisputable. So many people have checked that, and right. That part is, yeah. And I think no one has really raised any serious doubts so far, but it's such a complicated thing, yeah.
Perlman has claimed to do it all, is that?
To prove geometrization, and I would assume it'd take probably a year or two, right, before people would know. Right? That would be my guess. I don't know. I have no idea. It's just pure speculation, but whether it's correct or not.
Does that include the Poincaré conjecture?
Yeah, that would include the Poincaré conjecture as a special case, and that's been, you know, known since, you know, Thurston conjectured geometrization. It means that if you have a three manifold, there's a prime decomposition, so we can assume it's irreducible, so we can cut out these two spheres like that, so there are no essential two spheres. And after that, there's a torus decomposition, which was known. Okay, but what Thurston said is that if you cut along these tori, you get open manifolds. Each of these open manifolds has a complete locally homogeneous metric on it, a geometric structure on that. Okay, and so it can be decomposed, each three manifold can be decomposed into geometric pieces like that. And many, many results will just, you know, I mean, much of three manifold topology, there's a lot of work on, you know, what that implies, that conjecture, and particularly implies Poincaré conjecture.
Yeah. You said a lot of problem stuff works in higher dimensions, but I guess there's no sensible analog of it in the Thurston conjecture that people are trying to prove in higher dimensions.
Right. I mean, you can't even classify four manifolds in 4D. Then. Okay, so going back to this Harnack estimate, I think, to me, it would be a really interesting question. It'd probably say a lot of things about Ricci flow, maybe useful for weak solutions, things like that, continuing past singularities. I would think it'd be a great thing to, you know, work on and continue for, right? I mean, I think, you know, people would want to know that. To prove a Harnack in general for arbitrary initial data, that would, must say a lot, I would assume, yeah.
That's presuming people are interested in Ricci flow.
Yeah, proper, yeah. Yeah, which I think they it would be great if, you know, there's some, you know, just, I mean, topologists obviously are just, you know, just want to know, is it correct right now? But I think, yeah.
So this neck pinch works on any dimension, right? You take a cylinder, it always shrinks down.
Right, but the thing is, there's surgeries that can, so you could do this kind of thing, you know, SK cross, you know, B, N minus K. And you can kind of reverse surgeries. So what happens in three dimensions, what happens geometrically, what you expect to happen geometrically because of curvature pinching is that the surgery can only simplify the manifold. So if you do Ricci flow in higher dimensions, like, you know, four dimensions, like a borderline case, you know, five dimensions, you could reverse, you know, things could, you reverse the surgeries, right? And it's not necessarily simplifying the topology of the manifold. And so to try to derive topological conclusions from that, it'll be harder, I think. And also technically, just higher dimensions because of the curvature tensors. So I can write down one formula here, which is kind of nice, which is shown in Hamilton's paper in 86, is that if you look at the curvature operator like this, say from two forms to two forms, it satisfies a heat equation, right? And then there's a quadratic term, the square of the operator. And there's a square to, so the curvature operator is acting in two forms. So that's, as Lie algebra, you can make that Lie algebra using a metric, which makes an identification with SL, little SLN. And so you have a Lie algebra SLN, and you can square it using those structure constants. So there's a Lie algebra square here. And this thing, in three dimensions, it becomes very simple. If I write out the sectional curvatures as lambda, mu, and mu, and I can write out, I can drop those Laplacian and do that philosophy of looking at the ODE. Now it's a system ODEs. In three dimensions, I just have three curvatures. So in a sense, when I diagonalize this, I can just look at a system of three ODEs, and it's very simple to write that out. Lambda is equal, the time derivative of lambda is equal to lambda squared plus mu nu, like this. And corresponding equations for the other eigenvalues. And but in higher dimensions, you don't know the effect. In four dimensions, that's kind of borderline case, because SO4 is SO3, directs on SO3, and we know that. So we have the splitting just depending on metric. And then on SO3, you know it's just a cross product, the Lie bracket. So this is one of the main reasons why lower dimensions are easier. It's just an algebraic thing, you know, the Lie algebra being simple like that. And what's actually interesting is the Harnack I have not talked about, and that is actually a matrix, and it's an extension of this curvature. So actually it's a very complicated thing that's formally very similar. So there's kind of, the Harnack is very geometric too. Yeah. Okay.
You mentioned Perlman introducing the dilaton in this talk, but is he still dealing with Ricci flow, or is it a more general flow? I don't quite.
He's really just dealing with Ricci flow. He does look at a modified flow, but he pulls back, you know, modified Ricci flow where you add the diffeomorphism term. Then he just says, well, there's this, you know, you can pull back and go back to looking at Ricci flow.
Is the dilaton generating the diffeomorphism term or something?
Exactly, right. So intermediately, he looks at a modified flow, which is geometric equivalent. But really, when you want to prove things, you pull back by a different mode and get back to Ricci flow. Yeah, so it really comes back to Ricci flow.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.